This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
There was a problem.
A technical hitch.
There's a problem with the buttons, and it wasn't my fault this week. It's really good. It's really good. Natalie's saying it's her fault, but I think that it's not really anyone's fault. No one's to blame. I'm not pointing the finger at anyone. But what I'm gonna are we saying it's a pre-record?
Let's say it's live. Let's pretend it's live.
It's live, but we're broadcasting to you 30 seconds in the future.
Perhaps it's all coming from the future.
It's
coming from the past.
But then if you listen to the podcast, it's not live.
Sure.
And by all means, punch that like button and hit that subscribe and listen to the podcast, because we've got a podcast.
We've got a podcast. I imagine it'd be quite funny for a lot of people listening.
This is the podcast.
It's the same, isn't it? Just without the music.
You imagine it'd be quite a lot funny for...
I was going to say it'd be quite funny if you listened to some of the early podcasts, because it probably feels like we're a bit more unprofessional and not as slick as we are now if you listen to some of the early ones, I reckon.
But also if you listen to them, the early ones, it's even further in the past.
Yeah.
even less live.
Yeah.
One of us is busy on Friday today now, as you're listening. Mm. So we're pre-recording on Monday,
which means
we've only had a weekend. Guess which one?
Guess which one who's got another engagement?
That makes me feel very uncomfortable, Nat.
No, I mean, good for you. Good for you.
Oh, do you know what, though?
Hope it's fun.
It's good for me.
Yeah, it sounds like a good show.
Yeah.
I like watching it. It's good. It is a good show. So,
you've just deleted all the stuff. My name is Nick Helm.
And my name is Nathaniel Metcalf.
And you're listening to Nick and Nat's Fan Club. That's Fan Club. First rule of Fan Club is tell your friends about Fan Club. Second rule of Fan Club is please, for the love of God,
tell your friends.
Tell your fucking friends. Don't keep it a fucking secret.
Some of you haven't been telling your friends.
It's not like we want to own them. We want to own them. It's like, tell your friends, isn't it? The least you can do is tell your friends.
It's Christmas. Give them the gift of Fan Club.
Christmas! It's not quite, though, is it?
No, but it will be. But before Christmas, tell them about Fan Club, and then tell them at Christmas and after Christmas.
We had a lovely email message come in saying, "Good morning, Nick and Nathaniel." It's normally noon, so that's wrong for a start. And by the time we'd got to it, it would be like past noon. So it's good afternoon, Nick and Nathaniel. Love the show. Easily one of the best on digital radio. All right.
Easily.
All right. That's like a bit of a dig, isn't it?
Negging, isn't it? I think Frank is trying to get us to fancy him.
Yeah.
I think.
Love the show. Easily one of the best on digital radio. I saw The Grinch this week, and although it was deeply average, it made me think about recent Christmas films. I'm struggling to remember any decent ones. So, what are your fave Christmas films from this millennium? I'm going to be rather edgy there, Nat, and I'm going to say one of my favourite ever Christmas films, not from this millennium, it's Die Hard. You wouldn't normally think of that as a Christmas film.
Is it a Christmas film?
It's a Christmas film. It's going to be a bit more edgy. One of my other favourite Christmas films is a little film that I like to call Lethal Weapon. Is that a Christmas film? It's set at Christmas, isn't it? Do you know what one of my favourite Christmas films is? It's going to be a bit edgy here. I'm not going to say what you expect. Gremlins. And Gremlins is one of my favourite. I don't care. Thinking outside the box there. The VHS box.
You wouldn't spot this, but you know a lot of Shane Black's films. They're often set at Christmas.
Do you know what one of my favourite Christmas films is? Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Is that set at Christmas?
Is that set at Christmas?
Iron Man 3.
You're such an alternative person.
The long kiss goodnight. Yeah. Actually, The Long Kiss Goodnight is a good film.
Yes.
It's a really good film.
Great movie.
Oh, all time.
Well, I mean, all those movies you mentioned are good movies,
all
to
time
be fair.
Best. They are all good, but what fucking hell. Do you know what?
Do you know my favourite Christmas movie is? What? It's a Wonderful Life. It's quite very Christmassy. And it's nice, isn't it?
Yeah. But that's not just like... That's like... you know, what... I thought we said it before, but it's like when you go... What's your favourite song? It's like All I Want for Christmas Is You. No. Not what's your favourite Christmas song, what's your favourite song? Yeah. All I Want for Christmas Is You. And It's a Wonderful Life is genuinely your favourite film.
It's my favourite movie, yeah.
Of all time. Do you think that is because you'd like to live in Bedford Falls?
I think a bit, I do.
And do you know what? You are a bit of a George Bailey, aren't you?
In a way, I like this nice.
You're a good man at heart.
I'm trying to be a good man at heart.
Deeply flawed
and suicidal.
but you are a bit of a James Stewart, I think.
That's nice. I like the film. I try and be a good man in the world.
I think of you all like James Stewart in Vertigo. you're a sex pest. you are quite abusive.
But you know what, Nick? I think you're a good person too.
Oh, thank you.
That's okay. But I think you are. That sounds like it's a joke, doesn't it, by doing it in a funny voice? Really? Whereas it feels like
do you know what?
Tries to be nice and sincere, but it actually sounds like... I think we're all good people, aren't we? We're all trying to do our best.
No, we're not all good people.
We're not all trying
to do our best. But,
most of us in the world. Or I like to think most of us.
Yeah, but that really... like you don't know how much I needed to hear you say you think I'm a good person.
Of course I think you're a good person.
And then you immediately undo that by saying, I think we're all good people in a way. And then you go, what? Including despots?
Yeah.
And dictators and fascists and the anyway, I'm not going to be political.
I think you're a good person. Yeah, very nice person, very kind person. I think you're quite big-hearted, and you've got a big heart. You like to share things with people.
Thanks, man.
It's all right. That's fine.
I do need to hear it every so often. Thanks, George. George Bailey.
You see, it really was a wonderful life after all.
Did you ever read Back to Reality? Better Than Life, the second Red Dwarf book?
Oh no, I didn't really get into Red Dwarf and Red Dwarf books.
You never were into Red Dwarf at all?
I liked it when it started and when I was a kid, and then it felt like, I remember it having like a couple of years off or something, and I remember watching it in about the first or second year of secondary school, going, Red Dwarf, son, I love Red Dwarf. I remember it starting again and going, This is not for me. And had a weird like thing like, oh, I thought
later?
I liked this. It was like, well, I guess it was still in the main run. I think it must have been a time when it had a couple of years off or something.
It would have
been. And in my head I was like really like, I thought I was really into it. No, it would have been older than that. So
in
yeah,
series 7.
Maybe it was that.
Yeah, the original 6 series all ran together.
Oh yeah, so it was probably that then, whenever series 7 came out.
And they were all great. And then the later series were a bit difficult. The last series was excellent.
Okay, I think that's there was a break, and I watched it and thought I was really into it, and I remember watching it and being like, oh, was it always like this?
I think Red Dwarf is quite a weird one because as a sitcom, it's really funny, and it was always really funny for the first six series. Before there was a natural break, there was 6 series that were all together that sort of like gradually improved as they went. I think the pinnacle was season 5. Series 5, which was my first series that I got into it, and then I went back and got all the videos and stuff. And then Series 6 was really good, and then it had a really amazing ending, which was kind of a bit like Blackadder Goes Forth, only in space. And then there was like a natural... There was a hiatus where it was sort of meant to be a to-be-continued, but in a way it was kind of perfect the way it ended. And then they started doing it again... And yeah, it wasn't quite as it wasn't quite where it was. I think Rimmer got written out of the seventh episode, seventh series. They tried to do sort of like some weird things, and Chris Barry was doing some other stuff. He wasn't really available for it, and it wasn't quite the same. And they got another actress in to play Kachansky, who wasn't the same actress that played her before. And
that's right.
Like a bit of Chloe Arnett, and it was kind of like, oh, because it was Claire Grogan.
Yes, yeah.
And it was just kind of like the little things like that were. But then I also think that the emphasis went from being a sitcom to being a science fiction show with some jokes, and that was kind of like a big, for me, that was kind of like a big thing. And I did a. Oh my god, I mean, how are we meant to have a serious discussion about Red Dwarf with stuff like that written on our screen? Harold Shipman wasn't very nice.
No, he wasn't, to be fair,
but he did try his best.
He tried his hardest and he did very well. And what he tried to do, he was very successful.
So when I was at school, I used to read. There were two really good.
I remember the Doing books.
It was Rob Grant and Doug Naylor, and then they had a creative.
And the
split.
Books aren't in the same universe, or are they in the same? They're sort of like alternative timelines or something, aren't they?
What are they? They're basically Red Dwarf if they had the budget to do everything they wanted to do.
Oh, okay, I get it. So like, it would be like if there was a movie, it would be that.
I guess in the old days when they were trying to get a movie, I always assumed it was just going to be kind of like this is what it'd be, because they amalgamate. It's not episodic in a way where it's like then it's this episode, mm-hmm. then it's this episode, but they kind of like pick the episodes that go well together, and then they combine them all to make kind of like a series, and then they do Better Than Life, where in the game it was. No, in the TV series, it was they basically go down to a beach, and there's a Marilyn Monroe lookalike, and they're in like a virtual reality game where it's better than life, and none of them really want to leave. And in the book, at the end of the first book, Lester ends up in Bedford Falls.
Oh, right. Now I remember something about this. I have been told about this before.
And he had the opportunity to leave, but then he goes, but he couldn't leave her. Not on Christmas Eve, but then in Bedford Falls.
It's always
Christmas Eve.
What a lovely idea.
And when that's how it ends. And you go, oh, he's never going to come out of the computer game. And then there's the sequel, which is, I think, called Better Than Life. And a large portion of the first half of the book, they're in there. It's good. Those books were brilliant. And even later on when they started writing separately, I still really enjoyed the books. But I think there was sort of like... there's something magical about those two working together.
And what was the thing of that? Do they don't work together anymore? I remember those guys also did a series called The 10%ers.
Yeah, I remember The 10%ers.
It was about agents, wasn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember who was in it, but I remember watching it and then going, this isn't in space.
But, yeah, and it wasn't.
It wasn't, but they used to write, didn't they used to write for Spitting Image? And they used to
I think they were certainly like big sort of writers at the time, weren't they, of the day, of the sort of 80s and 90s, of that set.
Yeah.
I've just been reminded here, Nick. That's quite a cool thing I saw you doing at the BFI. You're doing
I'm not ready to promote that yet. Anyway, so we were talking about Christmas films. So your favourite Christmas film.
And film is It's a Wonderful Life.
Is It's a Wonderful Life. This Grinch thing, I saw a trailer for The Grinch.
Yeah, it's a new The Grinch, isn't it?
CGI. When I went to see, I keep wanting to call it We Will Rock You, but Bohemian Rhapsody.
So do I.
And do you know what I also want to keep doing?
What?
Watching it again. I loved it so much. There's something about the way that the kid from Jurassic Park at the end when they're doing Live Aid, he's sort of like box stepping around with his bass when they're doing Live Aid. And there's no footage of him really at Live Aid. The actual footage was very Freddie Mercury centric. Mm-hmm. So the others are kind of, I guess, improvising, or they're kind of like, they've been... They're all getting standout moments, and he just sort of like this box step with this bass, and it's such a...
It's probably really difficult for the fella that plays Freddie Mercury, because he probably has to be super accurate, because he knows the Queen fans will be very like...
I think he even does a thing where he takes a sip from the Pepsi glass just before
exactly
he starts
singing.
Exactly
the same
singing. Time. Yeah,
so he's obviously had to study it, and they've gone, this is this bit, and the other three are going... Well, this is easy. Just do what I like.
Well, apparently they did all of that.
Rami Malek, he's called, isn't he?
They did all of that on the first day.
The Live Aid stuff?
Yeah, they did the Live Aid stuff on the first few days of filming. They spent the first week doing the Live Aid stuff. And I think that I saw an interview with Rami Malek. Mm. So an interview with him, and he was like saying that basically he just assumed it was because if they fucked that up, then they'd just pull the plug on the film and be like, well, we haven't got an ending, so we're not going to waste everyone's time by doing it. If you haven't got the... If the whole point of your...
Yeah.
If the whole pinnacle point of your film, which is unbelievably doing an entire recreation of Live Aid, of their whole performance, because they start and you just think they'll just do the one song and they do all of the songs. Did we talk about this the other week?
It's just like, I know you spoke to me about it. Yeah,
it's fucking crazy because you go, surely
they'll just cut away now.
You'll do Bohemian Rhapsody. Hmm. Okay, right. Are you doing the next one? Okay, well you probably do two or three to give us a taster, and it'll be like a montage of the. Oh no, you're doing the third song, fourth song. This song, you're doing the hot, and it's fucking crazy. Because
is it filmed like a concert, almost like if it was live, or is it filmed like a film?
It's filmed like a film,
right?
And because you've got the concert footage, so they haven't tried to recreate the concert footage,
right.
But it's like a film. But which is when you see something like A Star Is Born, and how far they've pushed how you can film a lot. I think I'm not sure how I feel about A Star Is Born. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people loved it. Mm-hmm. I liked parts of it, mm-hmm. but I also thought equally it was simultaneously the best and the worst film I'd ever seen. Not ever seen, but there were some very bad bits in it. But I thought the live performance part of it, that opening scene when he's... where is he? Where's the gig? Was it filmed at Glastonbury? Or was it filmed... What's the other one? It was filmed at Glastonbury. Coachella, so they filmed at Coachella and Glastonbury, and just really, really amazing. When you've seen that within the last 6 weeks, and then you see it's very CGI, you know, in Bohemian Rhapsody.
In Bo-Rap.
Bo-Rap. So it's kind of like, it's interesting comparing them together because it doesn't have any of that live energy, but what it... It's weird. I'm so surprised with myself because I went in not wanting to hate it, but I went in knowing I was going to hate it.
Mm.
And then when I loved it from the very first... even before the film started, when the fanfare comes out, when I loved it from then, it was just like... Oh, wow.
It's shaking you to your core. You're a different man than you thought you were.
Well, I was really... I saw that it was on my Skybox, and I was just like, oh, brilliant, I'll download that, and I'll watch it again one night. And then I was disappointed to find out it was a pre-order.
Oh, that's a bit much, isn't it?
So I was a bit disappointed about that. Anyway, before that, there was a trailer for The Grinch.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you go, yeah. And I'm not a fan of the Jim Carrey Grinch.
No, I only saw it for the first time last year, and it perhaps wasn't as bad as I thought it would, in that it's like, it's got that episodic thing where you got bits of it where you go, I mean, this would be like, if it was a TV thing that was half an hour, it'd probably be all right. There's just so much, because the story only needs to be, like, if you read the book, it would take you 5 minutes.
Well, I like the original Dr. Seuss animated.
Oh, it's brilliant. Yeah, Grinch. Chuck Jones won the Chuck. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely brilliant with Boris Karloff.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Is it Boris Karloff?
Yeah,
that's
playing
even
the Grinch.
Cooler,
yeah,
isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah, right, okay. So I like that. I remember watching that when I was growing up. And then the Jim Carrey one makes me feel sick. It makes me feel like I've got some sort of flu kicking in. It's like watching Batman and Robin, you know, that sort of, like, it feels very contained on sound stages and very garish.
Yes.
And I actually feel claustrophobic for Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
Just thinking about, and all the actors have got fucking makeup stuck all over their faces, and it's just kind of like, it makes me feel very claustrophobic. But it's been several of my girlfriend's favourite Christmas films.
Oh, really?
So,
I read a thing that was quite interesting at the time, that it was Ron Howard did it. When he made it, he said it was coming out of the cusp of them just switching over to sort of digital effects.
Right.
And he had this thing where he said, I just want to have a go at making a practical effects film. And so that's why it's Rick Baker, isn't it? He does all the kind of makeup for it. So it's this idea of going, just before I can't do it anymore, I just want to make one big kind of essentially like fantasy practical effects movie again, like a sort of Willow again, just because he sort of was aware that era was ending. And so he was like, I'm going to make a kids film, and I'm going to really resist using any of the new technology and try and do one last bash at having like a... And when I heard that, I went, nah, that's quite a nice reason for you to do it. I like Ron Howard, and I like you, Ron Howard. I think you're a nice fella.
I don't hate it. I mean, this is so off topic. I mean, I don't hate the film, and I think Jim Carrey's really good in it, and all of that. And I don't hate Ron Howard as a director, but I do find that film very claustrophobic, and it makes me feel like...
Oh, it really does. It makes me feel hot.
Yeah, and really uncomfortable. You can just imagine watching it just before Christmas with most of the lights out, except for the Christmas tree lights on, and the film is on, and by the end of it, you feel very sort of oppressed and uncomfortable.
You're right.
But with this new one, you've got the Grinch, and all the way through the trailer, he's smiling and playing with his pets, and yeah, you go, that's very un-Grinch-like, dude.
Yeah. And it's Benedict Cumberbatch, isn't it, who's the voice of the Grinch.
Yeah, but he's doing an American accent. Yeah. Okay, fine.
And it's called The Grinch rather than How the Grinch Stole Christmas, and I wondered, and because it's out like already, I was thinking, is it even that story, or is it like...
It is. But,
okay.
But also it's a little bit, well, I guess The Nightmare Before Christmas stole off it to a certain extent, where he's kind of like... trying to steal everyone's presents, and I don't know. This is based on a trailer, but I saw the trailer for it, and he was just smiling all the way through it. And you go, well, that's not that's wrong for a start. But you can't make a film called The Grinch and then go, oh, hang on a minute, kids probably don't want to watch a film about a miserable man, so we'll make him, you know, pretty fun and cool.
Yeah.
And he hangs around with his pets, and his pets go, can we sleep in your bed with you? And he goes, yeah, all right. I mean, mind you, if you don't want to show a film about a grumpy man at Christmas, then it's pretty brave of you to show a man that sleeps with his pets. He's not a man, he's a Grinch.
The Who's down in Whoville like Christmas a lot, but the Grinch, who lived just north of Whoville, did not. The Grinch hated Christmas the whole Christmas season, but don't ask me why, no one quite knows the reason. Could it be...
Keep going.
Hang on, how much do I know of it? I love the book.
This is like me and Rapper's Delight. I start off quite confidently.
Hang on. Oh, what is it? Perhaps his shoes.
This is terrible
now.
Keep going.
Yeah. I've lost it. Okay. I've lost the thread.
I saw my first Christmas film of the season last night.
Oh, yeah.
I watched The Family Stone. Starring,
hang on, what was that?
Starring Diane Keaton, Rachel McAdams, Claire Danes, Sarah Jessica Parker. Who's the dad? Who's the dad out of Poltergeist? I always forget his name.
Oh, Craig T. Nelson.
Craig T. Nelson.
I like him.
Dermot Mulroney, and of course, Luke Wilson. It was not a good film.
Oh, well, I sort of vaguely... When did that come out? I vaguely remembered it.
Further ago than I thought. It was like 2004, I think. Yeah, but it's like a real... I always thought it was like a Sarah Jessica Parker... 2005. Sarah Jessica Parker romantic comedy. But in actual fact, that is an element to it. But it's a real ensemble piece. And when did Rachel McAdams... when did they do The Wedding Crashers?
That would be around the same sort of time, right?
So, yeah, but it felt very much sort of like... I mean, they've shown us a picture here. Dermot Mulroney, hot. That's what Natalie said. If you're watching... Yeah, I wouldn't recommend The Family Stone.
I quite like that it's called The Family Stone, and they seem to have cast 7 people that couldn't look unlike each other.
More unlike each other.
The idea they all belong to the same family.
Well, they don't, is the thing. Mm. So you've got Dermot Mulroney and Owen Wilson.
Yes.
Luke Wilson.
Luke Wilson.
Dermot Mulroney and Luke Wilson playing brothers. And you just think, it's a shame, isn't it, really?
Who could they have got?
Who could they have got to play Luke Wilson's brother?
Maybe someone that'd have like a... It's tough, isn't it? Because you'd have to find someone that has like a family resemblance. And they've got Dermot Mulroney, and he doesn't look anything like him. But, I mean, but who were they going to get? Who could they possibly have found that looked like Luke Wilson? I mean, there's the Royal Tenenbaums film, isn't there, where they cast...
It's weird that, though, isn't it? Because you've got Owen Wilson and Luke Wilson, and they're in the film about a family, but they're not playing brothers. And they, I don't really think they've got any scenes with each other.
No.
I think Luke Wilson is so good in that film. Oh, he's so good.
A very moving film, isn't it? That's a Christmas movie.
It makes me cry every single time.
Is it? No, it isn't. No, it isn't, is it? I'm thinking it's because their name's Tannenbaum, and that's Christmas tree in German.
Yeah, it is. Nat King Cole did the version of it. Oh, Tannenbaum. It's weird, because he's talking in German.
Yeah.
Claire Danes and Sarah Jessica Parker play sisters, and they look nothing like each other.
No.
It's a weird film. It's not a weird film, but it is kind of like on the cusp of being kind of like a Royal Tenenbaums-ish film.
It wants to be the Royal Tenenbaums.
It sort of wants to. It wants its cake and it wants its Christmas cake. And
I mean, to be fair, it's got a good cast.
It's a
smashing cast.
I said before, I love Craig T. Nelson.
Yeah, I love him.
Especially in Poltergeist. But and he's Mr. Incredible from the Incredibles movies. Anyway, it was my first film of the season. I watched it last night. Did not like it. On Saturday, though, I've got loads of things. Wanted to talk about how I've just watched a couple of Richard Gere films.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sort of like reevaluating how I feel about Richard Gere. I've never really loved him.
No, I haven't really. I mean, that he's. I think I've slightly misjudged him because I think I missed his sort of 80s hate. I think I was too young for him to be like prime gear.
Yeah, and he's got a USP which a lot of other people that you could kind of like put in his wheelhouse don't really subscribe to.
What would that be?
So I've always loved Pretty Woman.
Yeah.
That's like one of my childhood films. When I saw it, I was just like, I love this. It was just... I saw
Pretty Woman for the first time about 3 years ago.
Oh, really?
And I really like... I think this isn't what I think it is. And when I watched it, absolutely wasn't. I thought it was great.
Oh, yeah. It's such a romantic film. It's on my list of stuff like... I mean, I love Dirty Dancing as well.
It's also... much more of a sort of shocking film than I was expecting. I thought it was going to be much more played down.
Isn't it the reason why they invented Touchstone? Or was that, am I wrong?
Oh, maybe.
Because it's a Disney film.
Right, and it's, Buena Vista, isn't it?
They had to sort of launch Touchstone so that they could release more adult films. I'm not sure if that's the exact film that it was. Anyway, so you've got like people like Kevin Costner. Who else would you put in that list? You've got Richard Gere, Kevin Costner, Michael Douglas, Harrison Ford.
Sort of. I think my thing with Richard Gere, which I think sort of sets him apart, is that I always think he's a sort of quite a pretty boy actor, right?
Yeah, but he exclusively... So I watched Officer and a Gentleman for the first time, expecting it to be this really romantic kind of film about a guy that tries really hard and he meets a woman and he carries her off and she wears his hat.
You thought it was going to be a film of a man who's both an officer and a gentleman.
But he's more of a cunt that becomes slightly less cuntish.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh. And then I watched American Gigolo and Primal Fear, and even Pretty Woman, he's a bit of a dickhead at the beginning.
Mm.
And he just plays arseholes. That's what he does. But when I saw Officer and a Gentleman, I was like, oh, I don't like this because I don't really like the lead character. He's very unlikable. Then you watch a lot of Richard Gere's films and he's always unlikable. And it's like he goes out of his way to play arrogant dickheads who are completely unlikable. And in actual fact, that's given me a new respect, because someone like Kevin Costner will be kind of like trying to protect himself the whole time and be like, no, I've got to look the best I can possibly look in this film. And I love Kevin Costner, but that's kind of like, oh, right, I'm going to make Field of Dreams because it's about a great guy. I'm going to make JFK because it's about a great guy. You know, and flawed, but great, you know. And that's that's kind of like what Kevin Costner goes out to make. And I've always kind of like lumped Richard Gere as kind of like a lesser Kevin Costner.
Yes,
and
yeah.
And then when you watch... when you actually start sitting down and watching Richard Gere films, you go, oh, he's trying to do something completely different. He doesn't give a shit whether he's likeable in the film. He's just letting all of the work speak for itself, and he's actually creating... they're not flawed, but great men. They're just flawed, pretty ugly men. and Richard Gere's doing them, and it gave me sort of like, I think Primal Fear is a really great film where he plays this really arrogant lawyer, and I'm kind of really into that era of 90s thrillers where they feel very much of their time. They were kind of like the Morgan Freeman did kind of Along Came a Spider, mm-hmm. and then there was stuff like The Bone Collector, and then I guess Seven came along and just absolutely destroyed that kind of blueprint. Mm-hmm. But there's even stuff like the Tommy Lee Jones film Double Jeopardy, all of the John Grisham films like The Client and The Pelican Brief, they all feel very sort of like mid to late 90s.
Oh, yeah,
or even The Fugitive, right? Very sort of like 90s. And very kind of, they're almost like our equivalent of Agatha Christie thrillers.
But yeah, the Grisham ones were like massive, weren't they? Like for, there was probably a period of like 5 or 6 years where like they were almost like the biggest movies out. But from sort of The Firm, I guess, was the big opener till like, I guess, Time
Firm,
to Kill.
Was The Juror one?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm not sure if The Juror was
The
John
Client.
Grisham. The Client was a Pelican Brief, but then they started going really weird. They did
The Rainmaker.
The Rainmaker was Francis Ford Coppola. Mm. The Rainmaker, I mean, if you actually sit down and you watch the John Grisham movies, it's so interesting how each director, because from a distance, if you watch the trailers, they all feel fairly similar.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you just look up who directed The Pelican Brief, who directed The Client, and who directed A Time to Kill?
I have
Kill
a feeling
was,
The Client is Joel Schumacher.
Wasn't A Time to Kill Joel Schumacher?
It was, yeah, but I think maybe The Client was as well.
Right, yeah.
Like, but I think it was almost Joel Schumacher almost jumping on a bandwagon of like, we can basically make these. I think a lot of directors worked on those films because they're almost like guaranteed smash hits. Do you know what I mean? Because the books were so massive.
Oh yeah, but and who did The Juror as well? They so you watch. Which one did I watch? I watched one of the others. But then I watched The Rainmaker, which is Francis Ford Coppola directing
Danny DeVito
and
Matt Damon, is it?
And you watch them side by side. Client is Joel Schumacher. And Joel Schumacher wasn't a bad director. He made Falling Down, he made Flatliners, mm-hmm. he made Lost Boys, you know, he made some good films, but basically he was the guy that wouldn't say no to Warner Brothers when they said, we want Happy Meals.
Mm. And he was a costume designer, wasn't he? So he sort of made that the sort of thing of it.
Was he a costume designer? I thought he was a hairdresser.
Oh, maybe he was a hairdresser. I thought he'd come from that sort of costume.
Terrence Malick was a hairdresser, wasn't he?
Was he really?
I think so. So Rainmaker is Coppola, and it feels so much like a Coppola film. The acting is so loose, and it's less of a thriller. It's a thriller, but it's less plot based, and it is more character driven, where you have all of these moments of just Danny DeVito doing funny things. And I always remember the making of it, where Matt Damon had to look tired one day, and he had to look like he had a bad back. So they got a rock and they gaffer taped it to his back so that he looked physically uncomfortable. The Firm is Sidney Pollack. Mm. That's what I watched. The Firm. I could not believe my fucking eyes when I watched The Firm with Tom Cruise. Fucking hell, one of the most fucking insane things I've ever fucking seen in a film. Tom Cruise is walking around. Where does he go? He goes to New Orleans. I think he gets relocated to New Orleans where he's hanging around. He's just had a meeting with all of his guys. With all of his new bosses and stuff. And then they're walking after their meal down the street, just sort of like hanging out. And there's sort of like this black kid on the street who's like this street urchin, right? Who's wearing like one of them big floppy hats. And he's sort of like dancing for money or doing backflips down the street for money. And Tom Cruise sort of is in mid-conversation, and then he stands side by side with this little kid, and they sort of look at each other, do a nod, and then they run, and then they do a backflip competition, and you just like go, what? It's like something.
What film is this in?
It's like
they've just switched films.
It's like something out of like
Singing in the Rain or something,
or like Newsies, or like, you know, there was something that's just like absolute fuck. It's like out of like. Out of like Annie or something like that. It's just like absolutely crazy. And then
Bugsy Malone.
Never mention it ever again. And it's like it doesn't come back.
It feels so much as well, like you can imagine, Tom Cruise saying to Sydney Pollack, because it does feel like it's a Cruise initiated thing. Like, I've got an idea, and they go, I don't think that's going to fit in the. I think it's cool. Nice idea, Tom, but I don't think it's going to work in this film. So it's about the mafia.
Quite a serious.
Yeah,
film.
It's about the sort of mafia and about lawyers working for the mafia and things. So this is probably. I mean, I'm sure. Oh, I absolutely believe you can do it, Tom. I'm sure that looks great. I just think maybe in this film, maybe not. But it's up to you, Tom. It's up to you. What do you think, Tom? Do you think it's really...
We're doing it! And it's like, yeah, it's like one of them classic insane Tom Cruise things where it's like, nobody says no to me! When I heard that I got the part in the firm, I did backflips! it was fucking crazy.
Like, so it feels also that that's the reason he did the film.
Yeah, like, I'll do it if I can do the backflips that I can do.
And they go, that's not in the script, Tom.
Backflips! yeah, and I want every woman's nipples to get erect when they see me in Jack Reacher. okay, Tom, we can do it. We'll do it. Okay, ladies, action. Fucking absolutely incredible. Yeah, and then you get, like, The Gingerbread Man, which was a Robert Altman film. I think The Gingerbread Man was Robert Altman. And that doesn't work at all. And then they kind of, like, really declined. And it was like, actually, they don't work. And I even think that The Rainmaker was probably towards the end.
Yeah, it's funny, because it really had a sort of a life, didn't it, those John Grisham films?
I think Joel Schumacher absolutely smashed it. I don't feel like he was jumping on a bandwagon. I think he was exactly the sort of director to do them. And I think Francis Ford Coppola was jumping on the bandwagon.
Yeah, maybe.
Where
yeah.
he was kind of like, it was towards the end, and he was like going, well, these are doing well. I think if I did one of these, I could afford another pool.
Yeah.
You know, so... Anyway, Gary Fleder did Runaway Jury, which that's the Demi Moore one, isn't it? Yeah. And Alec Baldwin, that wasn't very good. Anyway, it's time to play a song.
Don't to know where you are.
Straight to the gallery.
Let's have a look at some of this.
Good stuff.
Lovely stuff.
If you've got any fan art, send it in and we'll have a look at it on there.
In a future episode.
Hit that like button and stroke that subscribe. I think that's what you do. That's what you do on YouTube, isn't it? What do you do on iTunes or whatever it is, whatever your provider is?
I don't know, comb.
But it's not comb. A like button, is it? You just subscribe. And then give us a review. We've been joking in the past. This is what lesser podcasts would do. They would beg for
please subscribe, please give us
a positive review. We don't give a rat's ass what you do. if you see it upon yourselves to get yourself over to iTunes and I don't know, give us a 5-star review. That's on you.
It's up to you.
But I'm not going to ask you to do it. Anyway, Primal Fear is a really good Richard Gere. And what I really liked about it was the trailer for it used to go, Richard Gere, Primal Fear. Have a beer. Because I saw this film, I started watching this film, I fell asleep, I have to admit, but it is incredible and I can't wait to finish it off or just actually rewatch it. Called Delamorte Delamore.
That's what's he called?
Rupert Everett.
Rupert Everett. Film,
it's incredible. It? It's so weird. It's about that. It's great because I saw it at the beginning. I saw it advertised at the beginning of another film that I was watching, and then I was like, instantly had to pause it and go, "What's this film?" Rupert Everett starring as he's sort of like a gravedigger. He's not a gravedigger. He works at a cemetery, and every 7 days the dead rise from the from the grave, and he's got to brain them.
It's based on an Italian comic book.
Right.
Called Dylan Dog. And it was sort of released initially. It was called The Cemetery Man, I think. And it's the Dylan Dog is a massive, absolutely huge comic book in Italy. And the artist that created Dylan Dog used Rupert Everett's likeness to make the character.
Oh, wow.
So when they made a film of it, they went, well, let's get Rupert Everett to do it. But then they realised when they were making the film that they didn't quite get the rights to Dylan Dog. So it's basically Dylan Dog, but they've changed all the names and enough about the film that it isn't officially a Dylan Dog adaptation.
Oh, wow. Have you ever seen it?
No, I've never seen it.
You know all of that off the top of your head? That's incredible.
But I like Dylan Dog. And in Dylan Dog, the actual main thing, his sidekick is basically Groucho Marx, and he's called Groucho. But in the comics, he's drawn as Groucho Marx. So his sidekick is just Groucho Marx. It's weird like that. But it's because it's in Italy. There's this weird thing where when they've been reprinted in America, they have to kind of like white out the moustache because in America, it's like, well, it's just obviously
Groucho Marx.
And he's called Groucho.
Well, I imagine his likeness is copyrighted.
Yeah. So, like, in the comics, it's basically this guy who's, like, a sort of supernatural paranormal investigator whose sidekick is Groucho Marx, who cracks jokes.
And that's amazing.
It's great. It's sort of a great... It's an Italian comic that's all set in London, and he has an actual London address, which I think is in, like, Kensington or something. But because of that, there's a cafe, I think, on that site that loads of Italian people go to try and find Dylan Dog's house.
Oh, really?
And there's a cafe in London which does it that know it now, and apparently they've made business cards that if you go there to sort of go, is this Dylan Dog's house? They go, sure. And they give you like his business card.
Oh, that's
cool.
So you
can go away and go, oh, I've got Dylan
Dog's. So they've embraced it.
Yeah, they've really embraced it.
Well, unlike the people that live near the Blue House in Notting Hill, the Blue Door in Notting Hill, where they just basically, every time there's a queue of people, they throw piss out the window at them. So Della Moore. Starring Demi Moore with the catering done by Del Monte and the soundtrack by Della Mitri.
Yes! And is it one spicy meatball?
It's a one that's spicy meatball!
Yes!
Had a lot of fun.
This is the best day of my life.
I can't believe you knew that much about that. I haven't even watched the whole film.
No, I got Cemetery Man. I bought Cemetery Man on DVD, and it was just at the time when I got a new DVD player, and I realised when I got it that it was a Region 1, and my new player didn't play it, and right, I had this thing. I went, oh, that's a waste of money. So, but now I know it's been released on Blu-ray.
Yeah, but also if you bought a Blu-ray player, there'd be Region 3 DVDs.
No, I think I've tried it.
No, it's but Blu-ray players play Region 3 DVDs.
Oh, do they?
Not Region 3 Blu-rays.
Hello.
But that's something that I worked out.
Maybe I'll do. Maybe I'll get myself Della Mora, Della Mitri.
Della Morte, Della More. The right time, the wrong me.
Could we get Della Mitri on it? Weren't Della Mitri the ones that did that football song as well for Scotland?
Oh, I don't know.
I think they did a World Cup song for Scotland. And because they were sort of aware that Scotland probably weren't going to do great in the World Cup, I think their football song was called Don't Come Home Too Soon. And it made them into sort of like national hate figures in Scotland. And they're like, you can't just do a song about how we're definitely going to be in it. Like, we're absolutely going to get thrown out in the first round.
Oh, can you look that song up? Yeah, that's great. Brilliant. Well, do you know what? I'll give you a full review when I've seen it.
To be continued in a future episode of Fan Club.
Hit that like, punch that subscribe. And what else? Oh, yeah, so based on Lucy Porter's suggestion, I went to see, not her suggestion, she didn't suggest I do it. Coincidentally, Lucy Porter came on and she said her favourite Steve Martin film was All of Me.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was looking up the BFI this weekend, and All of Me was on at the BFI. And I was just like, do you know what? When Lucy Porter was here, I didn't admit, but at the time when I was growing up in the 80s, it felt like a very grown-up Steve Martin film.
Right.
That I never really liked. And not that I hated it, but that I was more of a Man with Two Brains jerk fan than I was. And Three Amigos, actually. Mm. Which is like, that's basically, it's not necessarily a kids' film, but it's perfect for kids. And All of Me never really did it for me. And so I was just, so I've probably seen it once 30 years ago. And I went to see it at the cinema at the weekend, which I really loved the BFI.
Yeah, I need to go more often, really. I think I should really do what you're doing and look up whatever's showing.
It's just a nice place to go with friends and loved ones, and it's got a nice bar. It's fucking expensive, though. But
I don't like that bar, if I'm honest. I find the staff rude.
Oh, do you know what?
Incredibly rude.
I think that you have a case. You have a case there. It depends who you get, obviously. Such is life.
I've had multiple occasions of terribly rude staff there.
Yeah. No, I think that's. That's a fair point, but I think the people behind the counters, behind the actual ticket
office,
yeah,
they're lovely guys, great guys.
As are the people that work in the shop, but I mean, the shop is so expensive, I always just take photos and try and find it cheaper elsewhere. Anyway, so what I love about the BFI is, so 9 to 5 was on, and I wanted to see 9 to 5.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I didn't get around to seeing 9 to 5 and ended up seeing All of Me. So I think it was kind of like they'd done, if you like Lily Tomlin in this, then Lily Tomlin's in this as well. All of Me is great. Really great.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like there's moments in it where it's kind of, I mean, it's like Steve Martin going full Robin Williams, where he's kind of doing like a thing where basically it's about a guy, he's a lawyer who is representing this woman that he doesn't get on with, and she dies and her spirit goes into his body. And so his left side, I think, is possessed by Lily Tomlin, and his right side is Steve Martin. And you've got things where he's trying to learn to, they're trying to learn to walk together. So they're both co-inhabiting Steve Martin's body. And he just really goes for it. There's like this scene that's like goes on for ages, that is literally filmed outside this office block. And it's like a 5-minute scene where he's like, and it's got this huge set piece where they filmed it on the street, and it's basically Steve Martin just doing physical comedy.
Yeah. But when you gave that description, if that was pitched to Steve Martin, you could imagine him thinking, oh, I could do so much with this.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Just as a concept, that's the... Here's the plot of the film, and just even before reading a script or anything, or, well... but, like, you would go, that's the concept of the film.
Who,
you know,
wrote,
you can do.
Who wrote All of Me? Because it's Carl Reiner.
Yeah, so
it was 1984. I tell you the worst thing about watching All of Me. It was filmed in 1984. Steve Martin had already done The Jerk. He'd already done The Man with Two Brains. Mm-hmm. He'd already done Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid. He'd already been the biggest stand-up comedian on the planet, 1984. His character in it has his 38th birthday, right? And you go, fucking... Oh, yeah, that's right. It's based on... Is it a French film or a short film?
Oh. So it's a screenplay by Phil Alden Robinson.
It's almost like the sort of thing that you would assume that Steve Martin wrote, but he didn't. He's 38 in it.
Wowza.
And it makes you feel physically sick.
Yeah, I think I get that all the time with things where I go, oh, I guess that's... That's me now, isn't it?
Oh, God, when Bruce Willis made Die Hard, he was 22 years younger than I was when I watched it for the first time.
When Bruce Willis made Die Hard, he was 22 years younger than you?
Yeah.
So he was, what, 15? 11. He was 11 when he was in Die Hard. He looked terrible for his age, didn't he?
It's one of those things, isn't it? There was Robert Rodriguez always used to, where he said, Steven Spielberg made Jaws when he was 25, so I want to make my big film by the time I'm 25. I think he made El Mariachi when he was 22.
Oh, right, yeah.
But it was always like that.
It's probably good to have goals, isn't it? Whereas I think I'd probably go through life slightly... with less ambition.
We are different beasts, I think. Mm. Nah, I think that's maybe why we get on so well.
Mm.
We're not...
We're just getting on with things, trying to get on with, doing the best we can in a cruel world.
Yeah, well, I just think... one of the things that I think makes the... is not being competitive with people.
Mm.
I think that's the pathway to a happy life. When I was starting out doing comedy, I always just tried to keep my head down and just get on with it.
Mm.
And, you know, not like, oh, and everyone else was being very competitive, but it is a very competitive...
Mm. And I think it's got... That's become a bigger element of it, isn't it, in stand-up? I
feel certainly like in the last few years.
Yeah, it feels like... And I don't mean to... This feels like a sort of old manny thing, but it feels like there's much more of a...
No, but of our generation as well. It's very competitive. There's much...
Yeah.
There's less opportunities... more channels and less opportunities.
Mm. Although I think that we were probably the last generation of people that were a bit more, that we kind of got into it with much more of a, in the best way, in the French meaning of the word, an amateurish way of just trying to do something for yourself. But then I think it becomes like now I think it's much more of career focused, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think it was getting that way. But I think it was getting that way towards... After we were new acts.
Yeah. In my mind, I think it's probably the idea of someone like Russell Brand being in a Hollywood movie and going, and everyone in comedy going, oh, he was just doing gigs a couple of years ago with us. And that idea of, I think, someone who's gone from that to being in a Hollywood film sort of shows, made people go, oh, this is like a viable career path to being like a megastar.
I don't
kind
even
of thing.
Think it was that. I think it was... At the beginning of the 2000s, Jack D did Jack D Live at the Apollo, when he used to host it every week. And then he kind of like, I think it's still open mic, or it is open mic. So I guess he's still, which is his company. Is it not?
Is it Jack D's company?
I always thought.
Maybe it was. Maybe I'm wrong.
But I think it was Jack D's format or whatever.
Yeah, it was certainly a Jack D like a vehicle, wasn't it? Like the Apollo initially.
So it's still his thing. It's like Jasper Carrot owning Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Yes.
And he's like, who's the richest comedian on the planet? Jasper Carrot. He's, he owns the rights to Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And so I imagine Jack D still does pretty well out of Live at the Apollo. But it's like, but when that was the thing, it was just like, oh, we need comedians every week. And it started off with kind of like Joe Brand and Omar Jalili and, you know, oh, these are the household names, Sean Locke. And then it was just kind of like, and then it went like, well, and I think about mid-2000s, then it was just like, oh, yeah, we're all going to get a shot at this.
Yeah.
And the, it was just kind of like, I think at that point, there was a huge stand-up comedy boom. And that's when it became kind of like Amuse Moose started doing things. And what's going on? Okay, so then there was sort of like, so I started working at Amuse Moose and they started doing courses and I was just putting out chairs and stuff. And it was like, oh yeah, you can do a comedy course now. And oh yeah, you can do a comedy competition now. And then there were all these comedy competitions. And it was like, if you do this comedy competition, then you can get a gig. And then you do a gig. And then, and then it became kind of like, oh my God. And it was like the beginning of something where it's just like, oh no, because it used to be you do stand up comedy and then you do club stuff. But now you can be on telly.
Yes.
And then, and when we all started, I guess it was just sort of like, mid to late 2000s, and then it was like, hey, it gets us out of the house. And it was about the same time when people that were more professional that were thinking, hey, we can actually make a career this. But I never thought of it as a career.
No, I thought of it as just doing something creative. I just thought it was like a nice thing, and it was something I could do creative, like, rather than it was like, if I thought to myself, oh, I'll go and make a film, then it's like, well, I've got to then co-opt all these other people to help me. Whereas stand-up felt like something I could do that was creative and I wouldn't need anyone to help me with it.
Yeah.
I'd just do it all by myself.
No, absolutely. And that's when I made my... When I started boxing again, that's what I made my film about. Was when I started boxing again, it was like I was so shit at it and I was my health was rubbish and I couldn't, you know, you'd be boxing and you couldn't keep your... hands up.
Keep your mitts up.
Yeah, it was fucking... And you rubbish at it, but I felt so good that I was doing it, and I loved it, and it was just great to be... So, and it reminded me of when I started out doing comedy, where it's just like, I don't give a shit if anyone enjoys this but me, really. This is like... and many times that was the case. But do you know what I mean? It's just like one of those things where it's kind of like, I'm at the beginning of doing something. And this, I think, is applicable for anyone out there that's listening that wants to do something and is put off by what other people might think of them. I think if you... something positive and creative, guys. Not hate crimes, but I really want to do this thing, but I'm worried what everyone will think of me. Go ahead and do it, guys. Nine dead. I just think that
if you want to do it,
if you want to do it, and it makes you happy, then go along and do it.
In the words of Sheryl Crow, if it makes you happy, then it can't be that bad.
Depends what it is, Cheryl.
Yeah, it does. But,
Every day's a winding road. Not if you're a Roman. there's like...
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good. It's an oldie, but a great one.
An oldie, but a goodie.
An oldie, but an excellent one. And I just think if you want to go off and do something, whether it be stand-up comedy or whether it be... boxing, or whether it be going to the swimming pool and taking your t-shirt off and getting in a swimming pool in front of everyone. Don't let other people stand in the way of you living your life. And one of the things that I used to say to myself, and I still do, and I think it's a good analogy, is if you spend all your time looking over the fence to see what everyone else's gardens are getting up to,
then you're Tim Allen's neighbour.
Mate, it was going to be a beautiful moment. But then you're going to be Wilson. But that is almost, actually, that could be a thing.
Right.
If you're going to spend all your time looking over the fence and seeing what everyone else's garden's up to, then you're going to let your own lawn overgrow.
Lovely stuff.
So, you know, and it's good mental health stuff to just sort of like concentrate on you and not worry about what everyone else is up to. Oh, it's been a rough year. So, so keep it light. John Kearns is back. I love it. So we're going to play a song now. Have we got everyone wanted? Everything that we wanted to out of that? Oh, yeah, All of Me. Really great film. And it's got some absolutely amazing kind of classic Man with Two Brains, The Jerk style humour right in the opening credits, which I just wasn't expecting. But then it doesn't really hold through for the rest of the film. It's kind of like, it is a slightly...
It's a more sort of seriousy thing in general.
It's a more mature film.
Yes.
In general. It's less sort of like Scattergun.
Is that what you call it,
Scattergun?
Yeah, I guess it's more of a sort of bridge to some of his later projects.
It is, but even like the weirder kind of Steve Martin-y stuff that he gets away with in L.A. Story, like with the talking signposts and stuff like that, it's kind of like... It almost, that feels completely of its own thing. Like in LA Story, it feels like a complete film. Where with All of Me, there are moments like that, and then there are moments where it's kind of like not like that at all. And he's actually playing it straight, and it's kind of, so it's kind of like a bit of a weird mishmash. Where I guess him and Carl Reiner are both sort of like finding their it's like a bridge,
a bridging film. What they're going to do next.
Lily Tomlin's really great in it as well.
Terrific.
Okay, going to play a song. This is your song. Is that right?
Yeah, let's do it.
No?
Oh, yeah, it's.
Like the pine trees lining the winding road, I've got a name. I've got a name. Like a singing bird in the croaking toad, I've got a name. I've got a name, and I carry it with me like my daddy did. But I'm living the dream that he kept here. Bend me down the highway, rolling me down the highway, moving ahead so life won't pass me by. Like a north wind whistling down the sky, I've got a song, I've got a song. Like a whippoorwill and the baby's cry, I've got a song, I've got a song. And I carry it with me and I sing it loud. If it gets me nowhere, they're proud. Moving me down the highway, rolling me down the highway, moving ahead so life won't pass me by. Share it if you want me to. If you're going my way, I'll go with you. Bend me down the highway, rolling me down the highway, moving ahead so life won't pass me by. Bend me down the highway, rolling me down the highway, moving ahead so life won't pass me by.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
I did the long one by accident. I should have done this one.
Nick and Nat's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
A lot of fun. What a lot of fun.
Jim that was Croce.
That was, if you're interested, that was Jim Croce. What's the name of the song?
I have a name.
Yeah, I know, right, but we're talking about Jim Croce right now.
Yes, in there.
We're joined in the studio now by Rob Deering.
Hey, me.
How you doing?
All right.
Yeah. I was thinking then, when we were talking about All of Me and Steve Martin films, I thought, well, I bet Rob Deering loves All of Me. And
All of Me, that's great. I've been, in fact, I haven't seen it for years. I was just thinking of my shirt to the kids.
Yeah,
it's got one of the most joyous end credit sequences where it made me so happy that I didn't quite cry, but I am quite an emotional man, especially lately. But keep it light. it was such a beautiful ending.
I've got to watch it. I don't remember the ending, but I don't want you to tell me.
I want to rediscover it.
It's just the end credits bit, and you just like go, this is lovely.
I just think of the guy, the shaman guy who doesn't know what the phone is, and when it rings, he just sings along with it.
Yeah.
That is racist?
No, I'm not sure if it's racist, but it was annoying. I think that you're expecting it to suddenly go, oh no, this is one of them shameful things that happened in the 80s that you can't enjoy anymore. But I don't think it... I think it just about gets away with it not being a racial stereotype, because he is...
It's too weird.
It is too weird, and he's ashamed. But the thing about he doesn't understand about the phone ringing...
Yeah.
You just go, answer the fucking phone, mate. That's how you feel when you
watch it.
That
is a shame.
Amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. Yes. Very rare that we meet our match in the studio. Most people just let it wash over them, but you've dived into the deep end. what are you going to say, Nat?
I was literally going to say, how are you, Rob?
I'm good, thanks. Or rather, I'm well. I'm good. It's a very modern Americanism, isn't it? I'm very well, thanks for asking.
Do you like this time of year?
You mean...
Time of year you're listening to this podcast.
Yeah, this is a very special moment because we're in the pre-Christmas moment.
Well,
yeah. You know, when in the world of comedy, gigs are getting exciting without getting rubbish. You know, you can think about Christmas or not. And also, it's my birthday.
What? Today?
No, the end of November.
Oh.
But it's soon.
Soon.
You should probably give yourself a shout-out. What date?
November the 28th.
November the 28th. November the 28th.
Remember. November the 28th. Of November.
Here's a quick question. Are you cold?
I'm a bit cold, yeah. Was it because I'm.
Do you want to put your coat back on?
No, I'm fine, thanks.
You sure?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's quite warm in here, but when I went next door to find you, you were wearing a big.
I got quite
coat.
Cold today. I'm all right now. Yeah. This arm across my chest is held there because there's no armrest, and if I don't sit like that, I sit like that.
I find that a bit weird, yeah.
I do both, I do it all.
This I feel a bit like David Blaine. This is a weird chair. It's a bit like being on top of a post. You know, in the old days when people just used to live on a flagpole all summer, and because there was no internet, Americans would go, look, he's on a flagpole all summer long. I feel like that guy.
I feel, because I lean and then I put my feet up on here and I feel very relaxed, like Howard
Stern.
No, I'm all right, actually. Quite a friendly face.
You know, you said, when you said Eileen and put my feet up, and I put my feet up here, I thought, well, you put your feet up there, but who's Eileen?
Yeah. Come on, Eileen.
I beg your pardon?
I have issues with that song.
So does Eileen.
Oh, 2018. So what have you been up to? What have you done recently?
Ah, well, this weekend I performed at London's Hammersmith Apollo.
Oh, lovely.
For Roar With Laughter, the ZSL, the Animals Chat.
That's a great gig.
Lovely gig.
Yeah.
It was on, and it's lovely to play the Apollo. Obviously, it's nice to play the Apollo because it's big, but it's also, you know, I saw the Flaming Lips in there. It was like a gig of my life. And
right, yeah. I saw Motley Crue there. It was...
There you go. He knows.
I don't remember it, but...
that's how good it was.
It was.
I think the Apollo is a brilliant venue to watch.
That's
things.
The first place I saw Alice Cooper.
The Apollo.
But it wasn't called... What was it? What did you
say? Odeon in the old
days.
Hammersmith Odeon, maybe. That's when... In 2000... But that was 2001. Maybe it was the Apollo then. I don't know.
It was at one point it was the Labatt's Apollo, wasn't it?
Yes. But it's the Aventim Apollo now.
Aventim now, Apollo. Yeah.
It was the Brutal Planet Tour. And it was the... I couldn't believe that I was actually there.
When I saw the Flaming Lips in there, I kind of wasn't too bothered to go because my brother had got the tickets. I liked them, but I wasn't a fan.
What year was this?
Oh, good question. Probably about 10 years, a good 10 years ago, maybe longer.
Yeah.
And I was ill. I had a really bad cold, the kind that we would at the very least call a flu. It may have even actually been the flu. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to blow my brother out because it was a present. Mm. So I kind of limped over to Hammersmith.
Did you have your jacket on there?
It was like today, exactly. Yeah. I was wrapped up warm. And then it was just such a good gig.
Yeah.
And then when I saw them again, that was at Brixton Academy, I thought, well, this won't be as good because I had such low expectations last time, and they were just as good.
Yeah, that's great. I have not issues with the Flaming Lips, but there's that Do You Realise song, which if you listen to that when you're not completely braced for it.
It's not ideal, is it?
It's just such a fucking bleak song.
Yeah.
And... yeah, I find that so. Yeah,
It's like your response. You know, to they say, you know, do you realise that everyone you know will die? It's like, yes, of course I do. You didn't have to point it out.
Yeah, you don't have to point it out and use it on a Transformers 6 trailer. That's what they get. And you just like go, what is it, 6 or 5? But it's just like, it's,
well, let's clarify, because that's the important feature of this story.
But it's just like,
it's also important that the trailer is the only bit I see of Transformers movies.
Yeah, they do like one of their Marks and Spencer's kind of
John Lewis ad
versions of do you it's not called Do You Realise, is it?
I think it is.
And and then they use it in the Transformers 6 advert and you go, I mean, come on.
But I like, you see, I like a bit of nihilist hippiedom. I like that kind of, you know, it's like John Lennon's Imagine.
I don't like it. I think it's an absolutely incredible song. But what it does is, if you're listening, you're not always in the mood.
You're not going to be ready for that.
To contemplate your own mortality. Do you know what I mean?
No, I wasn't today. It's a prime example.
Yeah. You kind of sometimes just want to kind of, which is why I used to like the Polyphonic Spree. did you ever listen to them?
Yeah, because then I'm just thinking, what are they all doing?
Absolutely.
I really wanted to know what
the
distribution of labour was in the Polyphonic Spree.
Because there's like 50 of them, isn't
there? Yeah, and when you hear the record, you're thinking, I think you could have done that with 8. I'm confident that
there was some footage of the Polyphonic Spree on the London Underground busking. And they basically took up the entire ticket area.
I think it's their sort of outlaw, or the look of them, plus the fact they've got Spree in their name, makes me think of like the Manson family or something.
Or the Jonestown Massacre.
Yeah. I mean, plus, I don't think they killed anyone.
They only
fair.
Had that one tune as well. They only had that one tune.
What, Soldier Girl?
Yeah.
What's the other one, though?
Exactly.
I used to love Soldier Girl.
It's a good song.
To it over and over again. It's got 3 fucking lyrics in it.
Yeah,
he goes, I found my soldier girl, she's so far away. She's so far away, she makes my head spin around. I found my soldier.
It's not enough, is it?
And you go, you've got half a chorus, and then you repeat it for 5 minutes, and you've got 3 different versions of that song. It's fucking crazy. 22 members.
Yeah, what you want is 4 or 5 people and a couple of dozen songs.
That's
my band.
Not half a chorus that goes on forever. And also, it was like they were a bit like the opposite of Andrew WK. What's his? That was it. His name, Andrew WK. Mm-hmm. Where like. So all of the Polyphonic Spree's album titles were something like Having the Day, A Lovely Day, Singing the Day Away, Here's the Day. You know, and it was just like they all had like either the sun or day in all of the titles.
It sounds like the theme from Sesame Street.
Whereas in Andrew WKD, all of his songs have the word party in the title. Party Till You Puke. There are others. Party Hard. When it's time to party, we shall party hard. Oh, that's such a fucking amazing song that I really do like Andrew WK as well.
What era of the Flaming Lips was it when you saw them at Hammersmith? What were their current albums?
They were doing...
So did they sing that song?
Yes, they did. They were doing the big tour that they've been doing for a long time. So, I mean, it wasn't a specific album, and the big albums were a little while before, but they were still leaning on them. So the big ones are Yoshimi, Battles of Pink Robots, and the Soft Bulletin. Yeah.
That race for the prize isn't amazing.
So and they do, they open with that. And it's a balancing act, isn't it? They get it exactly right, because they're proper psychedelic all over the place, mm-hmm. and yet they're really committed, and the sound mix is perfect, and they still come together for verses and choruses, and they've got songs.
Isn't their first album called This Is What Happens When the Punks Start Taking Acid or something? And I think there's that sort of thing where you go, oh, what a lovely sort of, it's like you've written your own review.
Yeah. Talking of writing your own review, did you hear about this woman who was publishing a book, and she's a PR expert, and it was like how to build your brand, and it was sent to the shops with this woman, Roxy something, never fails to disappoint. It's read on the cover. They had to send them all back and poke them. That's not great growing your brand. That's exactly wrong.
That really happened?
Yeah, that happened.
And she's an expert.
Yeah.
And she wrote...
And all the proofreaders, it's supposed to say never fails to impress, and someone just never fails to disappoint.
And there's been this band this week, isn't there, or last week, that have... that booked themselves into massive venues and have bought their own Twitter followers and YouTube followers, and so they've managed to book themselves like a massive tour across Europe. But and it's something like Live Nation has completely funded this massive tour for them, but like no one's turned up to any of the gigs because they have just made up their own. They have just bought all their followers and things.
Sooner or later, that's going to happen, isn't it? I mean, that happened before he was kind of ironically famous and doing adverts and Panto. That happened to David Hasselhoff when he was, because he was always famous, right? He was a big star in Germany. That's the whole thing, you know, before the Berlin Wall and everything. And he booked a European tour, which was selling well, you know, in Paris, Stockholm, Berlin, etc. So, not really thinking about it, thinking Europe, he had himself booked into the NEC in Birmingham. And they sold 7 tickets.
Not really.
No, that happened in real life. Well,
7
as far as
tickets.
I know, 7. Wow. I just love the idea of them going and doing that show.
It
and
there were like
7 people together about 300
yards.
That's
like the Free Fringe, isn't it? Yeah. If there's 7 of them, yeah, I'll do 7.
Yeah, that's fine. I'm outnumbered. Why not?
It's fine. Like as long as there's more people in the audience on stage, it's fine.
Do you know what, though? If you knew that morning that there was only 7 tickets sold, you would book one, wouldn't you? You'd be 8. You go, oh, I'll be 8 to see... to watch David Hasselhoff with 7 other people.
If you were
people.
David Hasselhoff?
No.
If you wore like a beard and sunglasses. And
no, but I'd quite like to sit in the NEC with 7 other people watching David Hasselhoff.
They're not all sat together. They're spread out.
Of course they are.
It's a 10,000-seat arena.
or there's just a massive curtain off that just keeps like creeping up right up.
I did a gig like that. I did a huge room with 15 people in it once. It would have held 3,000 and everyone was off to one side. It's like, why can't we do this in that bar, please?
Mm. Yeah.
I did it once in a theatre that had about 15 people in, and they were all spread out, and it felt like, oh, go on.
Oh, spread out is a nightmare, isn't it?
Yeah.
I did 3 nights in a theatre that wasn't that big, but it was like 500-seater, and they hadn't... It was like it was a secret, and it was like the town it was in was dead. It was a Christmas special. They hadn't put it in the programme. They hadn't plugged it anywhere. And the town, and everyone had left town, and it was cold. And 3 nights, same bill. 3 of us went up there every night for 3 nights. And there were 60 people each night. And twice, they kind of all huddled together, and we just about got a gig going. But then on the 3rd night, they were just dotted around, basically 30 couples. 30 disappointed couples. 30 individual disappointed gigs to 2 people in one go.
What night was that?
Christmas time.
But would it be like a Thursday, Friday, Saturday?
It was like Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Oh.
Yeah.
But then that's not so bad. If you're disappointed by that, you go, that's something that we remember. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You'll remember that. Oh, remember that gig we went to?
It was great.
On a Wednesday. Didn't ruin a Friday. Didn't ruin a Saturday.
No, no.
Grow up.
Pam, what was your least favourite Christmas? Well.
It all started in Northampton.
Whereabouts are you from, Rob? Are you a London person born and bred?
Well, yes. I'm West London born and bred. Although, when I was 13, we moved out to the country.
Oh, yeah. Whereabouts in the country?
Oxfordshire.
And where were you in West London?
Heston. Close enough to, right under the flight path, close enough to Heathrow to qualify for the free double glazing.
Oh, lovely stuff.
I was in Kew Gardens recently and it was really nice. It was like the old days, not the plants, just the planes coming in.
When did you do your first Edinburgh?
The first time I went to Edinburgh in any capacity was in 1992. But my first Edinburgh as a comedian was in 2001.
When did you do Charmageddon?
Charmageddon, I think 2007.
Right.
I think.
I remember all the posters for that.
In a good way. Yeah. They're irritating you now to this day.
No. Yeah,
Looney Tunes spoof, wasn't it, Charmageddon?
Yeah, I remember it.
Yeah, I like that. Apparently, guitarist Richie Blackmore of rock bands Deep Purple and Rainbow grew up in Heston.
Ah.
Is that something you're aware of?
I don't think I was aware of that. There's not that much rock history action happening in West London. The Who are from Acton.
Oh, are they?
And so's Derek B.
I like it when people know every... It's small enough that you do know everyone.
Yeah,
you have got the full Wikipedia of any notable people from from a place.
I just remembered what I was going to say.
Great. From when?
From ages. He wasn't listening to us.
I was talking to my friend and we were talking about Edward Scissorhands, the ballet.
Yeah.
That was on at Sadler's
Matthew
World.
Bourne's Edward Scissorhands. Yeah.
And I thought it was awful.
Yeah. And I thought it was great.
I can't remember much about it, but I remember thinking, you've got Danny Elfman's music, and you've got Tim Burton's visuals, and you've kind of fucked it all up, where it looks like a cartoon, and there's no real weight or substance to it, and you've played it too light, and I just was annoyed by the whole production. And my friend, but I don't remember much about it other than the fact that I didn't like it. Yeah. And my friend went to see it. Her friend bought tickets to see it.
Were they cheap?
No, I don't think so.
It's a shame because we got some cheap tickets. They were a snip.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Scissor hands.
Carry on.
Scissor friend hands. Got the tickets.
Oh, okay. I'll continue. And my friend got the tickets. And her friend got the tickets. And they were like, expensive tickets. And good seats in the stalls, like third row from the front. And because it was around about Christmas time, I guess, they thought that they'd be able to get a taxi really easy. And they left it too late and then couldn't flag down a taxi and then ended up getting there after the start and they weren't allowed in for the first half. So they missed half of it and they ended up drinking in the bar. And then they saw the second half and they got to see everyone's feet really close up. But and it was just, it was a bit of a story. And you go, oh, right. Well, the thing is, I went to see it and I saw the whole thing and I don't remember anything about it other than the fact that I didn't enjoy it. And you went to see it and you only saw half of it. And, they had like this big conversation with all the staff that worked there and, while they were waiting to go in. And it's like, and they didn't get to see it. But she's got like a memorable anecdote out of it. And sometimes it's when things don't go as well that you end up getting something more out of it.
And even though, me and my wife, we liked it a lot, but still our story isn't as good, is it? It doesn't have to be even that you didn't enjoy it. Even if you did enjoy it, it's not as good a story, is it? Although me and my wife went to see Turandot when she was very pregnant. It was her birthday, so she was 8 months pregnant with our first baby. And I said, listen, it might not be comfy, you might not want to do this, we just go and see. And we went and watched the first half of this opera, and the seats were bad because they were the ones I could afford. And she was like, I'm not really comfortable. And I was like, neither am I, because it's not to do with being pregnant, these are terrible seats. And then so we went to leave, and we were hanging around in the interval waiting for everyone to go back in, so we didn't look like we were walking out. And basically the venue staff tuned in. We said, we might sit on this banquette and have a drink and watch it on the telly. Banquette. I just said that like it was like that wouldn't be worthy of. and they said, oh, come with us. And they didn't say what they were doing. We just followed them through this building, down an escalator, this one with the radio, and through here, up this. And then she opened the door and they put us in a box.
What a lovely thing.
Yeah. And we were right there. There was blooming Turandot just standing right next to us going, hey! and before the interval, she was half a mile away.
I do have a, the Sadler's Wells Edward Scissorhands does sound like it should be brilliant. It sounds like a perfect medium to kind of put it in, right? Having a sort of ballet and you think of Red Shoes and Tales of Hoffman and all that stuff being an influence on
it wasn't that.
And it feels like it should be, it should work perfectly. But I do have a problem with a lot of things when you see things at places like you try and see something like the opera or you go see something at the theatre, is that one of the things I find now is we're so used to seeing things in cinemas with sort of reclining seats. I always find that thing in theatres where it's like, this is extraordinary that I'm not even that tall, but my knees are like 2 inches into the seat in front of me.
Yeah, it's like when you go to, it's so lovely the idea of going to the Globe Theatre and being a groundling, but standing still, it's just physically painful.
Yes.
I saw Mark Rylance in Hamlet and was looking up and he was brilliant and it was great. And obviously everyone's really quiet because he's got the attention of the whole place. And I'm just thinking, I'm going to shout out because my neck hurts so much. I'm going to go, ah, sorry, Mark. Because just standing there like that, it's like someone stabbing me in the back of the neck.
I hate it. I really hate
these
it.
Are first world problems, aren't they?
I hate going to the theatre. I love the idea of going.
You love
to the
having been to the theatre as well.
And I love the memory of the plays and stuff like that. And I used to write theatre, but I realised that I prefer to be on that side of it.
Yeah.
Because just when you sit down in the middle of an art, and I know I don't really get this in the cinema. Sometimes I panic a little bit at the cinema. Mm. But just the thought that I might need a piss at some point during a live performance is just like, oh God. And then as you sit in the middle of the aisle and everyone else sits.
Well, that's your first mistake. You should probably sit in one of the seats.
Yeah, but you're not always in charge of. Oh, wow. Amazing. But as you sit in the middle of the row of seats, right, on your fucking seat. And the rest of the, but as each audience member comes in and sits next to you and blocks you in, they're like, each audience member is like a nail in your coffin as you become more and more claustrophobic, and you just realise that you're really all the way through the play now on the verge of having a panic attack.
Yes.
And like never before have you needed a piss. It's just sort of like all of a sudden, as soon as the play starts, you go, I think I need a piss. And the more I think about needing a piss, the more it's actually becoming a thing.
Also, I think that's one of those things that when you're in that position of needing to squeeze past someone to go to the loo or something, it's like you feel awful.
Dick
but if someone
us.
Did it
Dick
to you, if someone, if you were in that person having to move for someone, you wouldn't give it a thought.
You might.
You'd just go, of course. Of course, just it's that thing you often see in that I quite like seeing at stand-up gigs now, where it's that thing where like someone moves to go to the loo, and traditionally it would have been a thing where an MC might leapt on them or for just doing something normal. And it's whereas actually I quite like seeing it now when someone almost does a thing where they're sort of apologetic or look like they're about to get taken apart. And someone goes, well, of course, go to. Them.
I mean, yeah,
of course,
and also of course I always,
go to the loo.
I'm always
you
aware
need,
of time.
Need to go to the loo.
If that's like a really long half or a section in a show, and someone goes, it's like you kind of go to give them a hard time. You think, wait a minute, it's been like an hour and a quarter since the last
interview. Of course,
interview.
Totally reasonable.
I don't have a problem with people going for a piss.
No,
people
why
go,
would you?
People go, oh, I can't go for a piss. I'm sorry. Yeah. And I don't mind you going for a piss. What I mind is if you like make a big thing about it and you stamp down the stairs and you do, you know.
You can tell. You can tell when people are exhibiting attention-seeking behaviours.
But some people just you know, and it's that thing where the person on stage probably isn't drinking, where it's likely that you're sat there with a pint or something in the audience, and it probably will be a thing where you might need.
I think when it comes down to it, it's all about the fact that there's people there, because what you want at anything, like whether you're watching a ballet or a film or a stand-up gig, to really enjoy it, you need to sort of forget you exist.
Yeah, exactly.
And everything that works against that. So cinema's great because not only is it really dark and really comfy, but the people in the film do not care what you do because they've already filmed it, right? They're not there. So there's no way you can't disturb them. So actually you don't need to go for a piss. But if you did, no one would particularly mind. Whereas to achieve that in any kind of theatre situation, and then it gets exacerbated by how comfy you are, if you're brightly lit, whatever else can happen if you do anything, you know, the fact you actually have to sit still to not be seen.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when we go to those gigs and it's all brightly lit and you can see everyone.
Yes.
They're not having a good time.
Exactly. I think you just want everyone to have a nice time. And part of having a nice time is them feeling that they can go to the loo if they need to rather than being.
I think that's the only part that makes me think I want them to have a nice time. Is that they're free to go to the toilet when they want. I like them brightly lit. I like to see how uncomfortable they are. I like them to feel like they've been through something that they didn't necessarily sign up for.
Hey, you know, me and you, a long time ago, did a gig in a lovely posh theatre. Was it in Lincoln?
Yeah, it was in Lincoln.
I've never done a gig in Lincoln
since.
When
my parents, me and my parents came up and they got to meet you afterwards. It was a big treat.
Was it exciting?
Absolutely fucking smashed that.
Oh, you're very kind.
No, it wasn't.
I was thinking about it.
Not kind, it's a scientific fact. You did, you smashed it. You regularly smash it.
Yeah, it was nice playing a big gig the other day, you see, because I don't get to, you know, I have to do a charity gig.
That zoo gig is fucking lovely.
Yeah, oh, it's gorgeous.
I did that zoo gig a week after, I told you this the other week, a week after I did Live at the Apollo, which went badly. You can't tell. It was a great performance. One of the best performances of my life. I look like I'm enjoying it, right? But a week later, I did the zoo gig, and it was just absolutely lovely. Yeah. And you go, fucking hell.
Did you go on haunted by the...
I'm glad that I did because literally, it's like Brian Damage once said to me, he said, never be scared of a room. Like a physical room.
Yes.
And you go, yeah. So I'm glad that the week after that, I did it again.
Yes.
But I was disappointed that, why couldn't I have had a tough time at the charity gig?
What was the difference?
What's the difference? I think.
Is it that it's a sort of artificial atmosphere anyway, if it's been recorded for TV?
I think there is that. I think that there is a different audience. It's the same venue, but it's a very different crowd.
Yeah, and I guess everyone's got in for free there, haven't they? And they could be like seeing anything, but they're going to see.
Yeah, I was on right at the end of the night, and so I think I was on about 10:30.
Did they record like two shows? And
recorded two shows. Yeah. So we started at 7, and I think, yeah. I mean, I've got into trouble talking about this in a podcast before, so I probably want to avoid it a bit.
Okay.
But I think with the charity gig the next week, it's just like everyone's really up for it. It's kind of, my attitude towards charity gigs is always just sort of like, it's kind of a construct in order to get you to give money to a charity, isn't it? You're not actually paying for... a good night out, are you?
Well, yeah, but I think it's a balancing act, isn't it? Because you don't want to just completely forget you're there for a charity. But equally, if you push the charity thing too much, no one's going to have any fun. Mm. So you need to do enough charity that everyone thinks, I've been a good person.
Yeah.
Now, it's reward. It's activity reward.
Absolutely. But it's like buying a big issue. And then occasionally you'll get like some absolutely amazing articles in it and you read them and you go, that's great. But no, so... Yeah, my attitude is just like, if you're going to turn up and you're going to be pissed off and you're going to have an attitude, my attitude towards the Live at the Apollo is kind of like, you're getting a free night of comedy. You're not even paying, it's not even a charity gig.
Yeah.
In fact, I said that on stage. I said, why don't you treat this like it's a charity gig? And then I carried on with my act. I just stopped and I said, why don't you treat this like it's a charity gig? And then
I suppose the zoo gig, though, if you're at the Apollo anyway, you're probably quite excited to be there and you want to have a nice gig because it's in a big room and you want to have that experience.
I think
of
the audience really wanted to be kind of like, oh, it's a lovely occasion, but also you're filming a TV show when you're doing Live at the Apollo.
Yeah.
But when you're doing the zoo gig, it's kind of like the audience are just like, oh, they're feeling good in their hearts. They've given something to charity. Now, and obviously you want to do a good gig, but I think the pressure's off you slightly. You don't feel the same amount
of
pressure.
It's the best of both worlds, isn't it? Because it's kind of like a night off for everyone, but equally it's a big venue. It's got a rep as being a proper comedy gig with comedians who are going to give you a good show. And so everyone's got both sides of it. Like, it doesn't matter. We've given the money. The charity
is
already
out
a win.
The way.
Yeah.
It's done.
And yet everyone's like, they're not. It's not all super animal fans. It's people who want to see, people doing comedy, and then the venue's good. Like you say, ultimately, people do. This is a different issue, but in comedy, people worry about big rooms or rooms full of people. But a nice room with the right number of people in it is always good. Whether it's a 30-seater or a 10,000-seater, if it's a good space with people in it, you can have a good time.
Yeah, I think there is that weird thing, isn't it, where you've done.
You can have a terrible time.
Oh yeah,
and I've done previews to 3 people and you go, but it's that sort of thing.
I feel like Hasselhoff now.
Finally.
I've been looking for freedom. Yeah,
I shouldn't have booked the Bone NEC, to be fair. I mean, it was a mistake in hindsight.
But, took me in March. Only got 20 minutes of this.
But I've done it and had like a really nice time when people are just there. They've gone, oh, I've come out. I don't want to go home. I've come out to see this and I'm sort of invested enough to watch this for an hour and it's that sort of thing. You go, oh, I actually had quite a nice. That was quite nice.
I love previews, and I love work in progresses because you kind of like go. It says it on the. You don't obviously don't charge that much anyway, but then also it's kind of like, I think that we all go into it with the agreement that something tonight might be amazing. But I do treat like previews, as works in progress. You know, I often don't have a complete show until I get to Edinburgh.
Yeah, and that's healthy, but I'm not good at that. I want to present it's everything as a fait accompli.
Survival instincts as a performer is just that you can't go on stage and fail. And I think you put a lot of pressure on yourself. And I've done gigs like that where I've had a load of really great previews, but I haven't got a show. Because I've played the room and I've tried to make everyone in the room like me and go, I'm going to do a good job for you. But it works in that room and that room alone. And then by the end of my previous seasons, I'm still kind of writing. I think that happened in 2013 where it was an impossible show to preview, but I had all these previews booked in. And then by the time I got up to Edinburgh, I basically had to write it while I was up there. Well, I had like five songs, but I couldn't. Every time I previewed the songs, comedians would come up to me and go, how did that feel? where you'd go like, obviously it was awful, but these are the songs that I've written and they will work, but it's going to take the fact that I'm up in Edinburgh and I've got costume changes and I've got the lighting and the set, and I'm doing a show and you're making me preview this sort of song and dance thing in a venue that isn't appropriate. It's just weird.
I think, but sometimes as well, I tend to have quite good previews, and I wonder if that's because you are weirdly putting so much more into it because you're so desperate for it to work that you're actually doing something more than you're actually doing when you think it's finished. I often think that when at the point where I think I'm like, well, these have all been going well, I think this is good, and then when you start sort of relaxing and going, letting it sort of speak for itself, that's the point where I go, this isn't very good.
Yeah, I was selling it.
I was really selling this hard.
Yeah.
As in a preview, and then when you actually leave it to it, it's not actually.
Absolutely, but I think that's the case, isn't it? I mean, we were filming Uncle, and then it got extended for a week. So we went from... We went from doing 6 weeks of Uncle to 7 weeks of Uncle. I had a Christmas gig booked in for a fortnight at Soho Theatre, which started... So we finished Uncle eventually on the Friday and we started on the Monday. So I had to write this show over the weekend, had to recover from 7 weeks of filming and then start this show. And fucking hell, didn't have a show on the Monday, but somehow got through it because it was like, I have to.
Yeah.
And then by the Wednesday, there was actually a show where you just... But I've looked at the material since, and the show went fine, and the show went really well, but eventually, after half a week of it not being great at all, but I was selling the absolute fuck out of all of the material, and I don't think I've ever worked so hard on stage. Whereas you're going, if I don't do all of the work here that the material isn't doing, then I'm fucked. It was just sort of it was a really interesting
experience. So that's what leads to a good show. It's a corollary with what you were saying about having how a second-rate theatrical experience can lead to a good story. That ultimately, having a joke that you know can work, but it's only given to you 60, 70%, is making you do a fantastic performance.
Yeah, maybe.
So my new material should be second-rate.
Yes!
Well, I think that there's always a thing where, I don't know, I think that it's like a perfect storm, isn't it? Of the, it might not be the best joke on paper, but the way that you sell it, and the way that Helm and Taylor used to be our joke graveyard, where every time a joke didn't work, we'd do it in our double act, and it wouldn't work when we did it solo. When I just did a joke on my own and I did it, it wouldn't work, so I put it into Helm and Taylor because neither of us gave a shit about Helm and Taylor. And when we did, and because we didn't give a shit about it and we just fucked around on stage, it turned out that everything always worked.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a thing. It's kind of like you go, it's a perfect storm. It doesn't necessarily, it's not that, Carlo Simonetti's Goblin doing 50% of the work of Suspiria and Dario Argento, where it's kind of like you do have the material, but then you also have the performance, and they can kind of either you let the material speak for itself or your performance kind of sells it. but it's but kind also of like
another
it's
thing that thing about not caring is really key as well. Like I was in two bands at school, and one of them was like my dream, and that was what I was going to be when I grew up, was this singer songwriter with this three piece, and I'd do these amazing, meaningful, incredibly serious, miserable songs. And I was also in another band. I was a drummer. But I'm musical and bossy, so I was sort of like the MD, and I was writing songs, getting everyone together, and everyone was. It was a real, like, there was five of us, and everyone had an idea of what the band was, and we didn't really agree, and there was loads of tension, loads of different people writing songs. And that band was so much better, because we all purported to not give a monkeys.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It just made me give up on my dreams, because it's like, I'm in this band I don't care about, and even my songs for that band are better than anything that I wrote deliberately for my band.
Mm.
Even though I kind of said, oh, yeah, we need something to play at the beginning. So,
you're trying too hard.
Trying too hard is a problem.
But I think that's that it's sort of funny with gigs and things, because sometimes I often wonder, like, how much of something going badly is just a weird choice you make in your head. That there's probably a little switch where sometimes you go, well, if you turn up somewhere and when you say, oh, I've done that gig loads of times, it's a lovely gig. It's just, there's probably something, but when you go there, the audience is going to be completely different than were there the last time. And yet you've done something in your head where you go, oh, that's a lovely gig. So something in your own brain that decides, I'm going to have a nice time tonight. And you do, because
No, it never works like that. As soon as I say, oh, I'm going to have a lovely gig, that's when it's the worst gig I've ever had.
But that would also suggest that you're slightly self-destructive, Nick, and your brain goes, you're not going to have a nice gig.
I think that I always think I'm not going to have a nice gig. And
if you do, it's a lovely surprise.
And if I do, it's a lovely surprise. And so with that attitude, I end up having more good gigs than I would do if I went in going, this is going to be great. I think that, though, that nervous energy of thinking that you're going to die. I mean, it's so stressful. I mean, I haven't gigged all year because and I've never felt better. But because I realised that I was carrying around 12 years of just thinking I'm going to die at every point, and people are going to walk out and tell me how shit I am. But it's just sort of like, and that rarely happens. Yeah.
Mm. No, I think that's interesting. I mean, I'm similar. I have a thing where I get increasingly like, oh, I'm always sort of frightened about it going poorly. And sometimes that is a real battle, I think, in your head to sort of keep going. Whereas actually the reality of it is, it actually goes badly a tiny percentage of the time. But those times really, the weight of them build up much, much more than having nice gigs.
But also you just think, what if it goes wrong? What if it goes badly? And then you start in your head going, well, if it goes badly, I'll do this, 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 and this. And then you start planning for it actually being a bad gig. When in actual fact, when you're on stage and it goes badly, or you get heckled, I mean, it's like trying to prepare yourself for a heckle that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah,
you know,
I don't do this. I can be too relaxed about gigs, and sometimes I kind of I'm about to go on and I think, oh, I hadn't even crossed my mind that I'll be performing. Maybe that's a bad thing, but it generally isn't, because I kind of just surprise myself by being there, and I assume that it's going to be all right, and then it is, and then when if something odd happens, I tend to go, you know, oh, it's a surprise.
Well, I do,
and if I don't gig, I get really twitchy. It's a real natural outlet.
I think you're an incredible live performer. I think you're a really fun person to watch. No, but partly because you are like that, you come on, and that I don't think I see people as relaxed as you. Almost surprisingly so. I think there's that, especially as you have sort of lots of technical things in your act, that it feels like I'd be thinking, oh God, I've got to do that bit, and I've got to make sure I click this bit and I do this.
And I think that nervous energy, lots of people really thrive on that, whereas nerves and worry, they just don't help me. I just, in life, I just think, no, it's not helping me to do that.
When
I get more rubbish.
I think that every time I am relaxed about a gig, it goes badly.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I've got that in my head. So then I get so stressed out about gigs that it's almost unhealthy.
Mm.
And then when I do them, I do great. And I take that nervous energy on stage.
And you turn it into a good thing.
And I turn it into a thing.
Mm. Yeah.
But it's the ones when I'm relaxed is the ones where you just like, oh, God, you're not really in the room.
I like an element. I think the only thing I need in terms of like a alchemy to change it, I would really like to just be doing the gig. But it's good when there's a surprise. But it's like I like to just be distracted. The perfect gig is if someone tapped you on the shoulder and said, do it now. And you're just in like that, so you're almost just surprising yourself with it.
Yes, yeah.
I can't imagine any useful preparation apart from being so ready that you don't have to think about the stuff like hitting the pedals or playing the guitar.
Well, I think
I'd love to be you
for better. But no, but it's right.
I'd love to be you
for better or worse. I think you have that thing where you come in and you're either nervous, but as the sort of applause is going as you're walking onto the stage, you're either going, oh God, or you're going, I'm really up for it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's either one, whereas it's almost like, I think when I see you perform, you almost seem to have not, you seem to just be so kind of zen about it as a, as a thing. So it does feel like you do belong on stage, and you're very like...
Oh. Well, sometimes I think that works against me, because people think, oh yeah, he's all right. So they don't invest. Do you know what I mean? They're like, audiences think, yeah, he'll be fine. People will be watching him.
Right. And do you feel that? Do you feel that you don't get as much back as other acts?
No, I think once I'm there, I get it. I just think in the wider scheme of things,
right,
people don't think of me as having any kind of needs in terms of, you know, buying tickets to see me or giving me jobs on the television, this kind of thing. He'll be fine. He's got it all sorted. Look at him on stage. It's perfect. Meanwhile, they don't want to come and see my show. No, you'll be fine, mate. You'll be all right.
I'll definitely buy a ticket next time. I'm sorry.
It's too late. But I was just going to say that thing about the future, whether you're writing or it's the psychology, is that it will never be quite what you expected anyway. Yeah. So all preparation is almost pointless.
Yeah, I think that afterwards, where it is like, I think I'm someone who will overthink something, whereas actually it is totally pointless because you've no idea what it's going to be like until 30 seconds before you walk on, you know.
I don't know. Yeah, you don't know how are they going to react to you until you're on the stage.
And you shouldn't. So you shouldn't waste time thinking about it. And yet I will go, oh, I wonder what that's going to be like. I wonder what that's like tonight or what. But I can't help that. But it's silly to do that. You should just be able to go judge it in the 30 seconds before you walk on, really, and go, well, it's probably going to be like this. So,
yeah. Or it'll be both.
Yes, yes.
A lot of the time they hate me and they love me right at the same time. And you can see their faces and the, you know, people are laughing. And the person next to them is just scowling at you. And you go, how do you mean a fucking plan for that? They should all be laughing. It's all a joke. So ask Rob what he's a fan of soon, or you will run out of time.
We will. But this is
a
nice thing about it.
In a way,
you're just having a conversation.
In a way, this is the show, but it's not. So,
I think we've got time for
the song. So, what are you a fan of, Rob Deering?
Loads of things.
You are a fan of loads of things.
Yeah. I've done lots of preparation for this because I didn't know how it was going to go. See what I did?
Amazing.
Give me a type of media, and I'll tell you what my favourite thing is within that media.
What's your favourite song?
One song.
Yeah, you'll add one song.
At the moment, I'm listening to a lot of Sigrid. It's G Sigrid. I always want to say Sigrid.
I don't know Sigrid.
Sigrid, she's a new pop star. She's got a few things. I took my daughter to see her at Brixton Academy, and she's got choruses. It's good.
What's Sigrid's? What's her thing? What's her USP?
She's quite simple. She's quite austere. She wears a white T-shirt. She's got a great voice, and she's got good choruses and verses, and like that's it. It's very kind
Sigrid
of
Sigrid makes me think European from somewhere.
She's Norwegian.
Norwegian. Yeah.
She makes me think of a Las Vegas magician with a tiger.
All creatures, great and small.
Yes. I think it's interesting because one of your things you've put is Christmas songs. I love a Christmas song.
I often
collect Christmas albums from artists who I wouldn't get other albums by because I like the idea of them.
No, it's a wonderful thing. And I like it.
I've got a Metallica Christmas album.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's an album or a 12-inch single, but I own it.
Do you listen to it at length?
Not throughout the year.
And some Christmases even not then.
It was a gift.
Yeah.
And where do you stand? Where would you say something like, oh, what is it? Frankie Goes to Hollywood. What is it? What's it called?
The Power of Love.
Power of Love. Would you count that? Because it's not actually a Christmas song.
Well, yeah.
But as a video, which would suggest
I think you have to. Ultimately, if you have a big hit at Christmas, become per se a Christmas song. These days, that makes me think of Paul Young's Living in the Love of the Common People. That is not a Christmas song. It's Christmas number one. So when they play it on Magic, you're like,
oh, it's Christmassy.
Come on, guys, it's not Christmas. What are you doing?
It depends.
Stay Another Day.
It depends.
Another example.
Yeah, but that feels like a Christmas song. But it also depends if the song evokes the feeling of Christmas within you. It could be a number one Christmas song, but I don't really feel like what's the Donnie Darko one? Mad World.
Oh yeah, Mad World.
I don't feel like that. It doesn't make me feel like that.
And again, that was a kind of anti-Christmas single, wasn't it?
It was like
we're not going to do the Christmas one.
And then what was the other anti-Christmas one?
Rage Against the Machine.
Rage Against the Machine, and that doesn't feel like a Christmas song.
No, but so that's the statement about Christmas charts, rather than
We're
Staying Another Day, isn't it?
Staying
Another Day.
Well, they put fucking bells.
It's got a bell on it, is it?
It's got four bells in it. No, I'm sure they're all.
So I do love a Christmas song, and I like to, you know, and when people say I don't like them, I think, I don't listen to them then. It's just such a good moment.
Yeah, that Phil Spector Christmas album is absolutely fucking incredible.
It's super, super.
I've got that as a album.
As is the Nat King Cole one that you mentioned earlier.
But the Phil Spector one comes with a fold-out poster of Phil Spector wearing a beard and
his little speech,
and him, like, peering very... and you're meant to stick that on your fucking wall.
The Monkees have got one I'm quite excited about this year. They've released
a new
Christmas record with, I think, original songs.
Wow. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm less excited about that than you are, but I'm sure it'd be nice to investigate.
Sure.
I went to see the Monkees a couple of years ago, and they had, like, you know, the Monkees TV show used to have the cartoon of them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So who is it? It was Mickey Dolenz,
David Jones
obviously is dead now, died.
Mm-hmm.
So they just took his face off all the merchandise.
Oh.
So you buy a Monkees. I thought it was just the most cynical, sickest thing I've ever seen. It was like basically you had the 60s cartoons of the Monkees, but not Davy Jones. And it said the Monkees. And I've bought the T-shirt because I just said some. I've been.
He's now in his own locker.
I've got a theory about the Monkees. Would you like to hear it?
I love a theory.
You know,
I'm not sure if I'm up for it. Yeah, go for it.
You know how the Monkees are spelt wrong? Well, in fact, I say it's a theory. I'm pretty confident this is true. They called them the Monkees spelt wrong because the Beatles were spelt wrong. But the Monkees is not a joke, and the Beatles is.
Yes.
So they hadn't got the joke.
Yes.
Were the Monkees? It should be keys, as in you.
Yeah, piano keys. Yeah,
piano
but
keys and keys.
But
and that's not how they spell it.
That's
not how they spell it. No, but
and I think a lot of people never got the Beatles joke because they're so famous, it blinds you to the idea that they might be coming from a point.
Yeah,
of
but
wordplay.
The Beatles, right? The Beatles didn't really get the Beatles joke. When you hear them talk about it, they go, "Well, we really like Buddy Holly and the Crickets, and see, crickets is two things, isn't it? Crickets is an insect and it's also a sport." No, crickets isn't a sport. Cricket is a sport.
Yeah.
And it's just like, and what's that got to do with Buddy Holly and the Crickets weren't calling themselves the Crickets because of the sport? Be Buddy Holly and the Cricketers.
Yes.
Right? So, you haven't got it right.
It's just silly, isn't it? It's just
and
silly mid off.
And the Beatles is
the
like,
Beatles
because of Merseybeek. So, we wanted to sound like insects because of Buddy Holly and the Crickets. But then also, we wanted to have that whole Merseybeek vibe. That's quite a good pull.
It's a really good pull. Just enjoying the pull.
You should do a bit of head wobbling.
Because I normally.
What was that?
I'm trying to do Ringo now. Because I normally play the packing cases, don't I?
It's a good Ringo.
It's very good.
It's a good Ringo. I didn't mean to slip into one. I don't know who I am or where I'm from.
Oh. You sound like you're trying to be George. Hello, George.
Yeah. The only way to get to George is by doing that really horrible bit where it's like... if you tell me you want to play, I'll fucking play it. That really depressing bit from the... you tell me you want to play, Paul, I'll just
fucking play
it.
What's the bit that they spoof in Father Ted? What's that from? When it's going, just play the note. Just play that when they're doing the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yeah.
Is that right? Is that
it
from
might
that
be. It might be. Can I just say as well that the Bootsy Collins Christmas album, even within Christmas album judgment... is absolutely awful. Absolutely appalling.
The Bootsy Collins Christmas album.
Unlistenable. Whereas the James Brown one, either called Power Christmas, Santa's Got a Brand New Bag, Soul Christmas, any of those compilations are all tremendous.
The original Elvis one is amazing.
The Twisted Sister Christmas album is appalling.
We've got to do this. We've got to do the quiz.
We have to do it. We do have to do it, but we don't have to do it right now.
We almost do, right?
We almost do, but just don't. I've got one eye on the clock. I know what we're doing. But
one
we'll
eye
do
on
it
what?
Now.
On the clock.
On the clock. And
it's got one eye on the clock. I can't do it.
I've got one eye on the clock,
it's,
guys.
It's a new... And so that's how we came up with it. Because I came out of the studio one day and I said, I've got one eye on the clock. And that's why it's called One Eye on the Clock.
I'm not as good as the impressions of the Beatles.
I'll tell you yes! what, guys. It's been a real hard day's night. Oh, that's where we got the idea from.
Because it's not 7 days in the week, there's 8 days in a week.
All right. I'm John Lennon.
let it be.
This is tremendous.
What's happening?
Okay, this is the game. It's better or worse. We have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before. Mm. Starting with Henry Fonda. Is Jane Fonda better or worse than Henry Fonda?
Oh, she's worse.
Worse, she is worse. Is Bridget Fonda better or worse than Jane Fonda?
Worse.
See, I think she might be better. I'm going to go better. Is Morgan Freeman better or worse than Bridget Fonda?
Better.
I'm going to say worse.
I think he's better than he seems.
Bridget Fonda.
I like Bridget Fonda.
It's entirely based
on my own opinion,
yeah,
Nick.
Yeah. She was in Army of Darkness.
Brown is her high point.
Is Jennifer Jason Leigh better or worse than Morgan Freeman? Maybe better. I like Jennifer Jason Leigh.
She's all right.
Is Robert Duvall better or worse than Jennifer Jason
Leigh? Better.
Is Tilda Swinton better or worse than Robert Duvall?
Oh, they're high cards.
I like Tilda Swinton a lot, but
like
Robert Duvall is
high cards.
I think Duvall is better. Gary Oldman, better or worse than Tilda Swinton?
Worse.
I think maybe worse, yeah. I like it. It's a high card. Is Orson Welles better or worse than Gary Oldman?
How old is Orson Welles? He went off the boil so badly. Orson Welles?
Orson Welles in that alcohol advert where he's having...
Gary Oldman or Gary Youngman? Which one? Which
Gary Oldman is better than Orson Welles. Oh. Orson Welles is worse.
I think I might have to go Welles over Oldman.
Yeah, I'd take it back already.
I like Orson Welles' personality as well as his work.
And finally, Samuel L. Jackson. Better or worse than Orson Welles?
Worse.
I think worse. I think I'd say...
Better.
Worse.
And went the other way.
It's worse. Weird, though, because it's all based on...
My own opinion. It doesn't mean anything.
It's Nat's opinion, and he did tell you before what he thought.
I didn't realise.
Oh, you got
and
five.
A five.
Right. I thought you were really obnoxiously just shouting in my ear how much time he had left. But no, it was how many, what your score was, five.
Did I have to get it right according to your doctrine?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Well, that's a stupid game.
So you got five.
It is a stupid game.
No.
That's absolutely what it is.
You're in good Correct. Company. You're there with Yasmin Akram with five, and only Jack Berry with four, and Sam Ashurst with three is beneath you. So that's not a great score.
Have you anything you'd like to plug?
No, I just want to say at this point that I won Mastermind without getting my questions wrong, and I won the weakest link. So, you know, if it was a slightly more sensible game, I probably would have done better.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. But this absolutely isn't a sensible game.
I think it's important
to clarify
that.
What's your Mastermind?
Subject, novels of Jane Austen.
Oh, lovely stuff.
That was a happy autumn. I finished the Edinburgh Festival, and I had a tour in November.
Anyway, that's all we got time for.
I spent 6 weeks between the two.
No, keep
reading
going.
Austin,
just studying Jane.
Were you already a fan and then you did Mastermind?
Yeah.
And then what's the sequel to Pemberley? Is that the sequel to Pride
Death at Pemberley is the sequel to, or Pemberley, but you know, she didn't write it, so I don't care.
Well, in many ways, I prefer that one. I prefer Death in Pemberley and Star Wars Episode 8.
What about the Suspiria remake? What do you think about that?
Loved it. I loved Suspiria. The original is untouchable.
Oh, we know that.
So I just watched this as its own separate thing and I really enjoyed it.
Oh, good.
It's good. I'm capable of doing that. I'm 38. I don't have to get upset by lesser artists tampering with my childhood.
The only thing I wanted was...
You can't tamper with my childhood. It's in a glass box in my brain.
I wanted them to make it with kids. So, because it feels like it should have been kids, and Harry Potter's with kids, so it'd be kind of like a fun
I always describe Suspiria to people as it's like Harry Potter with witches.
We've run out of time.
We have run out of time. It's been lovely talking to you.
It's been lovely to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming in.
What am I going to play? Oh, I'll play Sigrid.
There we go.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks for playing this song.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows that the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows that you really do. Everybody knows that you've been faithful. Oh, give or take a night or two. Everybody knows you've been discreet. But there were so many people you just had to meet without your clothes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows.
You've been listening to a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.